also here to learn.
Yes. Last question. What's the situation with the forests in the Amazon? I mean, we've all heard about the degradation of Amazonia.
Well, I think like this last mandate has accomplished its promises. Like deforestation has decreased a lot since the President Lula is in power. We were able also to reduce the numbers of fires, and we are working intensively in trying to also to create alternatives for the forests. There are also alternatives for those that live in the forest. So I think like in Brazil, things have now, they are much better than like 5 years ago, 4 years ago. The challenges are still huge because it's like it's a continental area. So we need still to have a lot of funds for protection, removal of intruders, but it's a good mission to protect the forest and the planet. Is an honorable mission, and we have amazing people working in the Brazilian government right now, in the Ministry of Environment, in the Ministry of Indigenous Peoples, and now we are involving people, big people from the finance. Like everyone is trying to think, how can we support the forest standing? So this is like the TFFF is a big interministerial also initiative, not only in Brazil, but we are trying to connect the dots. So things are better, and I really hope that we keep in power like with the elections so that we can keep doing the work.
Thank you very much. Paulo Vargas is a consultant for Brazil's Ministry of Indigenous Peoples. Here's a guy named David Flood sitting alongside members of accredited NGOs at Forest Forum plenary sessions. Flood's hat caught my attention. I spotted him beneath that hat in the lounge area outside the conference hall. Could we speak?
Sure, he said.
Introduce yourself. Tell me who you are.
Yeah, certainly. Adishinaka Zonze Maingan, Matachwan First Nature, Odonjaba, Lingizi Dodum. My name is David Flood. I come from a northern Ojibwe community called Matachwan. It's up at the height of land in northern Ontario, called the James Bay Treaty, Treaty Number 9 area. And myself, I'm an Indigenous practicing professional forester. I was born in Brampton, Ontario, raised in Edson, Alberta for most of my life to high school. Got educated in forestry, technology, and forest management. Spent some time in British Columbia and bounced back and forth between northern Ontario and BC and back again. All in the name of Indigenous advocacy. Like I said, I'm a professional forester. I work with Indigenous communities in the Treaty 9 area around sovereignty, jurisdiction, and taking their place in forests, in their ecosystems, in the natural environment, at a time when climate change and climate adaptation is paramount. And some of the only ways to do that is to mobilize proper investments and capitalization into acknowledging the value of nature, at the same time as, well, we'll call it fulfilling the fiber needs of the world. We're putting high demands on the Northeast Boreal Forest.
And Earth's forests provide an incalculable sum of wealth, which isn't monetized. It's all externality. It's never factored into the gross domestic product.
That's what economics does. That's what economics does. They build scarcity. Scarcity is economics. So there's only a finite amount of wood. There's only a limited amount of wood that'll hit the international market. And they only look at the wood as the commodity. Yeah, nobody spent much time looking at the value proposition of nature. That's not true, though. We've been studying that a lot. We've been studying putting value on nature, clean water from soils, you know, the cycling impact, the coolness, the ability of the earth and the water and the trees and the ecosystems to regulate, provide habitat, country foods, medicines, proteins. I mean, it's not just what it provides, it's the benefits, the reciprocity and the benefits that we as human beings can get and utilize from that forest. We say the Creator never made us housing stock poor. The Creator never told us to stop utilizing the resources of the land. What they said was, don't take more than you need. And when you make a commodity out of wood fiber and you talk about scarcity and supply and demand, well, there's a trade war going on the east-west border between Canada and the United States around softwood lumber dispute, and nobody's winning that one. It's harming so many people. Meanwhile, the forests continue to be harvested at reduced rates and not the proper valuation of the kind of forestry practices that should be going on and those impacts on the forests in our north.
we rely, I'd like to think that we rely on forests for our psychic health.
Isn't it funny how just a few trees can actually make someone feel better? What about whole ecosystems? Societies can thrive in whole ecosystems. In fact, there are indigenous people around the world. What is it, they make up 5%, but they hold 85% of the world's biodiversity where they manage those lands, the indigenous people? I think that's a statistic you can live by. The most biodiverse lands are managed by the fewest population of the world.
But stepping back from that obvious truth for a moment, it isn't obvious to everybody, but it is a truth, that walking through the woods where you can see all manner of migratory birds and you can almost not hear the traffic, it, you just feel better. And you're breathing in the air that the woods are creating.
Well, humans need forests. Humans come from forests. Humans have been dependent on land and forests and shrubs and bushes and trees and ecosystems since time immemorial. We picked up agricultural and cropping along the way. That was just made for ability to create larger societies on smaller pieces of land, but we still need our forests.
So what brings you to New York City? You're attending the UN Forest Forum.
Mm-hmm. Well,
have you been to New York City before?
No, this is my first time coming to New York City and attending the United Nations. I heard about the Forum on Forestry. I mean, this is number 21. You'd have to wonder, as an indigenous practicing forester, why I've never made my way here before. The domestic issues we face in forestry probably can't be solved here directly. You know, consultation with indigenous peoples happens on the ground where they live, in the forests. So that's, again, I'm an advocate, right? So that's where I've spent most of my time, is trying to, you know, work with the mindsets of government and industry to try and change that dialogue and relationship. But the more I spend time in forestry and the more the world is spending more time focusing on forests and ecosystems and climate change impacts, all of a sudden, the dialogue is becoming very similar all the way from the international world all the way down to the ground. Everybody's learning to talk the same language and being more clear on what the needs are. This is, you know, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, for example, things like that. That fluency, and I often argue that that's just the world becoming more indigenous in their way of thinking, becoming more holistic and understanding in it. There's a plurality that needs to be achieved. Everybody should be benefiting. All boats should float, right? Everybody should be kept well. That's the only way you're going to have a better global society. But if you've been watching the news lately, and I try not to these days, is so much violence, turmoil, and wars over land and almost nothing sometimes. Just somebody making a bad decision.
And are you here just on your own, or are you representing a group?
No, that was the interesting part. I got invited because I'm a supporter of Forest Stewardship Council certification, the scheme, the international scheme. So that's the green labeling of wood harvested sustainably from forests that are all holding up all people's interest under 10 principles, including P3, Indigenous People's Rights, and following UNDRIP and EFPIC principles to implement that whole standard. So I'm actually the chair of the Permanent Indigenous Peoples Committee currently, and I've only been at that for about a year and a half now. As co-chair and now chair recently. So I'm here actually as part of an FSC delegation along with South Africa to talk about, you know, the value proposition on mitigating degradation and using certification as a tool as part of that exercise, because you're not supposed to do forest degradation under the standard. And of course, the reciprocal of it is, how does that actually create opportunities for indigenous communities to become full participants in the benefits derived from forestry and forest management, and from from an indigenous perspective?
And Certification, what are you referring to here?
Well, it's the certification of wood products, so lumber, pulp, byproducts that go into anything that is derived from wood and made from wood. There's a chain of custody that can happen, and there's a green label, a check mark with a green tree. You might remember that one on the back of most envelopes and paper products in the stores. If you carry that FM forest management certification or mixed wood labeling certification, companies are allowed to go to market saying they've brought that wood fiber from deemed a more sustainable forestry practice, which again, the reason why I'm advocating for FSC is it is a better standard than anything else currently in the world for a few different reasons. Not only is it just upholding Indigenous people's rights and the requirements of UNDRIP and free, prior, and informed consent consultation, but it also does a really good job at looking at large landscape conservation principles, starting to explore and validate the ecosystem services additionality that's created by the use of the standard. And then, of course, number nine being, as you said, you know, the well-being of the people that use or benefit from the forest, the high conservation value forests, so that companies have to hear from the rights holders, stakeholders, forest-dependent community people to actually set aside parts of the landscape that are deemed most critical or important for their use and benefit and well-being while they go about doing their commercial commodity work. So the first thing I'm doing is looking to see who's here representing Canada in the UNFF.
And there are folks from National Resources, Natural Resources Canada who are here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And our Canada
so
has
Megan
a little
Masters,
delegate.
Krista Mooney, and from what I understand after meeting them briefly, they've been in this role or position for some time. This is not a new place for them. They worked in the UNF space and the multilateral relationships, both provincially and federally throughout those jurisdictions on, you know, working back and forth between international commitments. I mean, what's interesting is I've heard, like, the UNF seems to be like a tie that binds, you know, the Paris Agreement, climate action, biodiversity, you know, the COP 15, the biodiversity targets out of Montreal. And of course, what do all those relate to? Forests, or as what we say in our language, the people and the land. The people and the land. Anishinaabe, Eski. Anishinaabe, the people, Eski, the land. Those are inseparable things. So we see ourselves as when we stand on the land and then we reach to the sky. We're not just reaching to the sky, we reach the spirit world as Anishinaabe people. So Wakotuin is the business that I work for. That's a Cree life philosophy, Wakotuin. Everything is connected in that whole, from the feet to the ground to the spirit world. The spirit world is the stars. We go back to the stars. We're star people. And so everything we do has an impact or action, and we have a reciprocity and respect stewardship relationship in that whole exercise. So me coming here is just another extension of what we're trying to do in our home territories up there, over 7 million hectares in northeastern Ontario, where there is predominantly FSC certification, hence why I'm pulled into the PIPC chair role and trying to work with eight other regions around the world.
PIPC?
Permanent Indigenous Peoples Committee. You know, the bottom line for me is, and I actually asked our Indigenous Foundation Secretariat to pull a list together. So we have complaints within the FSC system from Indigenous people under Principle 3, and then it usually launches an investigation. And so the idea is, okay, where there's a complaint, like there's a corrective action usually, or a non-conformance, they call it. Or it could be a major non-conformance where there's a suspension of a certificate, as an example. But the system is meant to be responsive to go, there's principles, criteria, and indicators. Those are evaluated. And of course, P3, upholding the rights of Indigenous people and other things. So they get evaluated, the companies. And this is all voluntary, by the way. This isn't government driven. This is companies saying, I want to go to market. I want to go to the world and access the world markets with that logo, with that standard intact.
It's interesting that that's a badge in 2026 that the forest industry wants to bear.
In what way?
Well, it sees a certain status or prestige, or it earns acceptance. Kudos, perhaps, even for adopting the standards that are put forward.
It's meant to be a market-driven experience, right? So it's actually more about you and I wanting to buy that logo, a market draw, as well as the other actors like the IKEAs of the world, the Procter & Gambles. We want FM-certified wood in our systems because then on our supply chain from the forest to our markets to our people, our customers, we can say that you are buying something that is sustainable. So, yeah, there is some prestige to it from the forest sector side, but I would argue more and more it's becoming, you know, the voice of what the people are looking for is, you know, they want that peace of mind without having to go to the forest to see if the Indigenous people are being harmed or if an animal is being extirpated, you know, or if the water is being dirtied or the trees are not being replanted. There's deforestation or degradation going on. That's the whole value proposition of certification, is that somebody's watching. The communities are participating. The workers' rights are being upheld. There's gender equity. Like, there's a whole range of things. So, you know, there's the SDG goals, and then there's the FSC standard. Oh, boy, there's lots of commonality
The Sustainable Development Goals.
Of the United Nations, the 17 listed goals, yeah.
Tell me about the forests of northeastern Ontario. And what type of woods?
It's the boreal forest.
It's the boreal forest. Any mixed wood in there?
That is the boreal forest. Yeah, it's not the Great Lakes forest. It's not the oaks and the, you know, hickories and, you know, that kind of thing. It's got a little bit of white and red pine, but you move right into the jack pine, black spruce, white spruce, birch trees, white birch, paper birch, taiga, swamp, peatland, mosaics of wetlands, the boreal forest.
So this is, tell me geographically where this is. It runs up against Quebec.
Yeah, well, I mean, the boreal forest is all across Canada, coast to coast.
And all around the world.
And all around the world. But yeah, so for the northeast where I call home, it's predominantly, as I said, the height of land. So if you know anywhere, and if you know your geography, we'll say about 8 hours north of Toronto on the Quebec border side, all the way across, we'll say the 51st parallel, between the 49th and 51st parallel. There's three communities I work for in that geography. It's about the halfway point between the Manitoba border and Quebec border that I work with in that boreal. Of course, the further north you get into the James Bay lowland, it becomes muskeg, swamp, peatland versus the treed area, which is a little higher up on the height of land side.
What's the state of these forests? How well are they doing? And I'm thinking, to what degree have they been impacted by insect infestation, by wildfire?
Our forests in the Northeast don't burn as regularly as the Northwest. Part of that is because we have stronger fire suppression. But the other part is our weather doesn't tend to get as high and hot and dry. And the lightning strikes in our area, although that's increasing. You know, we're getting into third pass harvesting now. You know, there was the early days of the pioneering of logging. We're definitely well into the 30-plus years of clear-cut logging and herbicide spraying and site preparation, more or less, you know, moving it into more monocultures, trying to grow the crop trees, the conifer crop trees, and spraying the deciduous. So
this is now. This is current, or this is past that?
That's now. Yeah, that's why I said we're into the clear-cut logging, well into the era of clear-cut logging. Now they're trying to mimic fire emulation through clear-cut logging by creating larger pathways of cutting, but we just experienced a 10-year decline in the moose habitat all in that northeast area. And then more recently, we just seen a spruce budworm outbreak that just in 5 years covered 100% of the northeast, starting in the balsam trees in the understory, but ramping up and becoming a bit of a epidemic into the standing spruce trees. So those are an interesting little moth larvae combination, because the larvae, if they can kill more than 60% of the foliage on a tree, the tree's probably not going to make it. So we got a lot of flags standing dead. You talked about fires. I am worried about fires this summer because we got a lot of standing fuel into that mosaic. You have to remember. So even in our mixed wood stands where we have spruce, those little moths and larvae have found those spruce trees and stressed them out. So, and died. You can see them, they're red and dead, standing dead. So that's a bit of a concern for the next 1 to 5 years. Well, you know, they're good for biodiversity in one hand, because they're creating standing dead for cavity nesters and things like that. So that's normal. But for it to hit a pandemic level where like 80 to 100% of the trees have been impacted, not dead, but impacted, and creating a lot of standing fuel, there's a bit of a stress for our region and our northern communities.
Makes them much more vulnerable to climate change.
Well, that and...
I guess they themselves are. I mean, the insects are themselves a sign of climate change.
Well,
they're responding to climate change, but then they accelerate the cycle.
That, and we've created the food for them based on our harvesting practices. It's like the It's like the pine beetle out west, right? The lodgepole pine beetle that raged and dumped over into Alberta, started in a park in BC, and that was leave it alone policy, and then all of a sudden just chewed its way all the way through northern BC, and then northern BC has had fire after fire after fire in these pine stands, dead standing trees, right? Now they're even actually experiencing in these monocultures that they had replanted, the fires are going through 30 and 50-year-old stands. They're burning through the young stands because of their density and contact, because of climate change and the heat.
I would imagine you'd have some really fascinating conversations with people from foresters from Malaysia or from Brazil or from Russia or wherever, like Korea. Wherever you've got forests, you've got foresters, yeah. And interesting stories to tell that can be knit together. You see similarities, you see parallels. Thoughts on this? I'm not sure if you've had enough time yet.
I think my issue with every one of those conversations is the math that's used, the economics, the capitalism that's used. You know, in some of those other areas of the world where there aren't unions and the workers are getting paid next to nothing per day in these massive, high-value trees, you know, capitalism reigns. The forest-dependent people, this is kind of, again, why I got on PIPSI, Permanent Indigenous Peoples Committee, is I'm tired of seeing cultural genocide happen through pointing the, whether it's a policy trigger or a forest legislation trigger, on sort of the use, access, and opportunities of Indigenous people to enjoy their rightful place on the land as stewards. And they pull the trigger and they say forest management is good, sustainability is good, and the way we decided to manage the trees is going to be great for you. Meanwhile, it's when I say pull the trigger, in some cases that's real. The trigger gets pulled on Indigenous people. Or it's through death by a thousand cuts, through some sort of policy or legislation that says, no, we've modeled this out. The forests are going to be fine, including when we herbicide spray and kill the biomass that Mother Earth is trying to put back into rotation, if you will, trying to heal herself, healed for the animals, right? And herbicide spray gets rid of all the deciduous trees, right? That's the goal, get rid of the competition, the deciduous trees. Well, the frogs need those, the aphids needs those, the moose needs those, the nesting animals need those, the birds need those because the bugs go and eat on those. You know, like, it's like, the birds don't spend all their time on conifer trees. They need that mosaic. They need that diversity. So do our bees. We're not thinking about all our relations, as we call it.
I mean, forests function. Forests are systems that are incredibly complex.
We can use all those words, but we say all our relations. Now you're talking Western science on me, and I don't like that. I like all my relations. That means the unknown. As I come through school, it was the art and science of being a forester. Because that acknowledged that we didn't know everything as foresters.
But we only know a fraction of how complex systems like forests function, how they work. And that's a scientific idea, but it's also a bit of a philosophical notion.
Who are you saying we?
Well, First Nations, Indigenous people. Indigenous people know.
Let's be clear. When you say we don't know how forests function, are you saying the Indigenous people do not know how forests function? That's my point. When you said we don't understand forest function, I mean, I even self-admit, I'm not my grandmother. I'm not her grandfather and great-grandfather. I guarantee you those people knew how the forest systems or all my relations really worked.
David Flood, Sonse Maingun, is a member of Matachewan First Nation, an Ojibwe band in Treaty 9 territory, northeast Ontario. Flood has been a First Nations advocate and a promoter of forests for over 30 years. These days, Flood is the general manager for Wakotowin Development, a social enterprise jointly operated by three First Nations promoting full participation in forest and land management across their respective territories. Listen to my complete conversation with David Flood and check out David's hat at greenplanetmonitor.net. In the final moments of the 21st UN Forum on Forests, in a quiet corner of the plenary hall, I spoke with Juliette Biao, Secretary General and Director of the UN Forum on Forests. No one knows more about forests than Ms. Biao. As West Africa's first female forester, she helped resolve forest-related conflicts in the international park separating Burkina Faso, Niger, and her home country, Benin. Since 2022, Biao has served as the director of the Secretariat of the UN Forum on Forests. Ms. Biao is a dual national of Benin and Canada.
Could you point out in closing, like, one or two key areas of work that would really, if they were to be advanced and financed and facilitated, would really bring, achieve headway in reducing the rate of degradation of forests? Is it support for indigenous people? Is it support for communities? Is there one, or are there one or two areas that really need to gather speed in order to start conserving forests and recovering forests that have been lost?
First of all, from a financing side, we need really to move toward innovative and private finance that we have not been able really to mobilize, you know, at the scale that's required.
Innovative and private initiatives.
Yeah. The second issue is really to reduce fragmentation and really reinforce the governance, and most importantly, address the key drivers of deforestation. Yes, we are planting. Yes, we are restoring the degraded land. But unless we address the key drivers of deforestation, which are mostly outside of the forest, we will not be able to address deforestation. And I'm talking about agriculture, I'm talking about energy, and I'm talking about infrastructure. We need to go in a balanced way. This is the time now to talk to the right audience, you know, not staying in our bubble of environmentalists, foresters, but also to engage with other sectors to really enhance this cross-sectoral coordination.
Where are the shortfalls? Where are the stumbling blocks?
The stumbling block is
mainly...
And
I understand that financing is a critical
financing
issue.
Financing is a big issue because, you know, the global financing so far has reached $84 billion, and yet the needs are close to $300 billion.
$84 billion have been raised, but you need over $300 billion.
Yeah, over $300 billion. The most important also shortfall is that countries are investing a lot in forest restoration, but unfortunately, the global forest area has declined by 40 million hectares in the last decade, meaning that they are investing, but you know the effort are not keeping really the pace of the degradation. So
degradation is happening more rapidly than...
We need speed, we need scale, and we need more investment.
You're very kind. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yes.
Juliette Biao is the director of the Secretariat of the UN Forum on Forests and West Africa's first female forester. Learn more about Juliette Biao's work with the UN Forum on Forests and the conclusions of the 2026 Global Forest Goals Report at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.